CITR 101.9 FM. Jeez, I'm not used to those punk songs. They're so quick. There we go. Have I got you, Phil?
How you doing?
Oh, fabulous. There we go. Inkstud, CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstud Show, the radio show where we talk about what, Phil?
What's that? Oh, we talk about comics.
There we go.
Yeah.
That was Gorilla Biscuits. Song was Start Today. Today's special guest is Dylan Williams. Dylan is the publisher of a small comics outfit out of Portland. Because really, if you're doing comics, I think you're supposed to live in Portland. Oh, there we go. I had my mic turn around sideways. Sparkplug Books. And we're going to talk to Dylan about his comics and other people's comics, maybe. Because from what I understand, Dylan's a fan of comics, which I guess you have to be if you're going to sink money into putting them out. So have we got you there, Dylan?
Hi.
Excellent. How are you doing today?
Good.
Dylan.
It's a little hard to hear you guys both, but...
Okay, here, I'll turn up our mics. There we go. How's that?
Yeah.
There we go. I think they're just turned down. So I guess we'll start out with tell us about your publishing house. I guess publishing house is the wrong term to use. Tell us about Sparkplug.
Well, it is kind of published out of my house.
There we go.
That makes sense. But I started a small company about, well, I don't know, what was it, 2002 or something like that. And it's just stayed small, and I just have a storage space where I keep all the books that I print and sell them to people. And I publish a lot of people who do self-publishing and mini comics, because that's basically where my interests lie. So
you do a lot of distro as well as publishing.
Yeah, I just started that about a year ago, and it's actually really turned out to be super fun and, you know, just as interesting for me, so I keep on doing it.
Awesome. So what was the inspiration to start your own publishing house? We're going to tell you these highfalutin terms today.
Who? Ian McKay and Minor Threat. I don't know. Basically, just ever since I was a kid, I've always sort of looked up to, like, you know, people who did all their own stuff. And I kind of, you know, just I was on that path anyway, and it just... You know, it made sense for me to sell other people's books for me, because I love, you know, talking about other people's comics. So, you know, Philip is a great example. I just, you know, he's one of the people I'm always pushing on people. So I really like I like doing that, and it's more fun than pushing my own stuff, which is really boring and not worth doing.
I don't agree.
Do you mean you don't agree because you like to push your own stuff, or you like to push Dylan's stuff?
Oh, I think Dylan's stuff is deadly. He sort of keeps his light under the bushel a little bit, but you know, I think some great stuff there. Yeah, you've got such a broad range of books there as well, Dylan. Like, we're just looking at the Asia Addict, for instance, like, and then you've got like the Tales to Demolish, like, which is sort of classic. Sort of rambunctious storytelling, like, at its best. And then there's the sort of more meditative stuff from Jeff Levine, like The Watching Days Become Years. It's a lovely range of material, like, and very, very individual voices, I think, is sort of a uniting factor.
Wow, thank you. you should write PR for Sparkplug.
If Phil has anything to say, it's always the nicest thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
I agree. It's still a little hard to hear him. It's not just the Irish accent.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, you got to get more direct on that mic there, Phil. Just jumping in his face.
Yell into it.
I've been learning to project lately, but...
Here, we'll just...
I've just taken away my pop guard, so I'm going to be very sibilant for a bit. So please excuse that.
No spitting. Spitting.
No.
Spitting. So what was some of the first stuff you published? Was it yourself, just pushing yourself out, or was it kind of picking something that really you thought was awesome and needed to be put out?
Oh, that's a super big question. Because, I mean, as Sparkplug Comic Books, the first thing I published was a book of my own. And then the next thing was Orchid and Fleep, or were Orchid and Fleep, at about the same time. But I've actually been publishing my own comics and publishing other people's comics since 1988 or 9 88. Yeah,
wow.
So
that's a lot of DIY.
Yeah. And, it's, you know, it doesn't seem like that long ago, but I guess it is.
We were looking at the orchid, both of us, today before the show. And it's interesting because a lot of the folks in there now have some great stuff out.
Are they now have their... They have their own books, like, which is pretty amazing. Like when you see the Gabrielle Bell and Kevin Isenga, of course, and like Ben Catmull's in there as well. Like a lot of these people have.
Todd Bach just had a book come out from Bodega.
That's right. Yeah, I just just actually picked that up today. It looks great.
Yeah,
and it's massive.
Yeah,
and it's great. Like it's sort of like a foothold when you know you're putting stuff out there. I think it's something that a lot of people don't realize, like when you're working on comics, it's like it's a big step to actually put things out there because I think the books, they become something else once they're out in the world.
Yep.
And it gives it's getting a start like that, getting distribution and getting comment back from people. It's like a huge it's a huge step, I think, in any artist's movement.
Yeah, I always worry that it's, you know, maybe putting people too much in the limelight or something like that. I don't know. For me, it's hard to know. Each artist is different. Some really want to be, you know, as promoted and all that as possible, and others just want to do a book and that's it.
I've noticed that while doing the show and trying to get people to be on the show, and some are all over it and others just not quite their thing.
Actually, yeah, so. It's Shannon O'Leary that got me to do this. She prodded me. She's my new promotions person for Sparkplug, and so she really pushed, you know, doing an interview and doing some readings at the library in town and things like that.
She's fantastic. So, Orchid, what was the thought? That was like one of your first Sparkplug things you're saying. So what was the thought behind the anthology?
Putting it together, like, started off, me and Ben Catmull wanted to do a anthology of H.P. Lovecraft stories, and then we realized that H.P. Lovecraft stories were just being constantly turned into comics, and we decided to pick a bunch of stories that we really liked, and then that we gave up on that idea and just decided to let people choose whatever Victorian horror stories they wanted, and some of them, like Green Tea, I gave Kevin like a list of, you know, or, you know, different ones that I thought he might be interested in. He chose that one. Other people knew exactly what they wanted. You know, Gabrielle Bell wanted Saki immediately. Actually, she was worried that he wasn't horror enough.
One of my favorites in there is actually the David Lasky one.
Oh yeah,
who is a marvelous illustrator. Like, he's just fantastic. But this is like, it's just about word placement.
David is the one comic artist that needs to have a collection of his work done, and nobody's done one. It's frustrating.
I concur. His I know that I think he's working on the Carter family stuff, isn't he?
Yeah.
That he had in the Kramer's Ergot, which is fantastic. So.
Yeah, I totally agree. He's got those things in Hotwire too, which
make no sense.
Been really beautiful.
They're wonderful looking, but I can't get heads nor tail of them, and I think he can't either.
Yeah, he was actually saying that, I think.
Making sense is overrated sometimes, anyway.
I am a fan of Burroughs, and half the time it's just not making any sense.
It's all about the flow.
Yeah. And that's the fantastic thing about Lasky's story, is that it's interesting and just very minimal stuff. So did you take much editorial direction, or is it you just kind of picked folks that you had a lot of trust in and just see what happens?
Yeah, I think I basically just... actually, it's Ben and I both, you know, co-edited it, so we both just picked people we really liked and let them sort of do whatever, no page limits or anything like that. And it was just a total blast to do.
Now, you're saying you first started putting out stuff by other people in the fine days of the late 80s. What kind of stuff were you doing then?
I started with a mini comic in Berkeley called Whiplash, and then continued with a book called Strange Air, which I started publishing in a class taught by Maury Turner at Laney College in Oakland. And that was just, both of those were just sort of anthologies. And Whiplash actually existed before me and a bunch of my friends, before I got involved. And a bunch of my friends were publishing it, and so I just got involved in it and then started working with them. But Strange Air was just something I published on my own. you know, I printed like whatever, I don't know, a couple hundred or something.
So did you get pretty involved in like the mini comic scene before jumping into the spark plug?
Oh yeah. Well, I still like see myself as that. I don't really want to be part of the big comic scene. I love mini comics, and I love that people do stuff themselves, and they're, you know, if they're into that sort of culture. That's, I don't know, it's weird. I did a book for Slave Labor years ago, and I did a book for Aeon years ago, and I tried to sort of get into the more, you know, above ground comic scene or whatever, and it just didn't really fit for me. It doesn't really feel comfortable. So I love minis.
I don't blame you. I go to Stumptown, I have tons of fun. I go to Emerald City, and I want to go home.
Yeah. There's actually a show in Stumptown is awesome now, but there's a show in Portland called the Zine Symposium, which is just my favorite show of all time. And I always come home with just so much stuff that I want to read and so many interesting, you know, you get like vegan cookies and all kinds of great baked goods and stuff. And it's so much fun.
So when did you relocate or locate to Portland? I don't know what's the proper term to use there.
I think in like 96 or something, we moved to Olympia, Washington, and lived there for about a year and a half.
Back in the Riot Girl days? Actually, that's post-Riot Girl days, isn't it?
Yeah, slightly post-Riot Girl. It was like when K Records was like really going strong.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, it's funny, we moved into the same building that Mr. Mike moved into, Mike Haig, who did Ron Jeremy's War Journal, and he's sort of a Minneapolis comic, you know, I don't know, leader.
Icon?
What?
Icon?
Yeah, icon, that's a good word. I don't know if he'd want me saying either of those things, but but I knew him through Zach Sally, and we just moved into the same apartment building just by chance, and so I spent, you know, 2 years basically just drinking myself crazy with Mr. Mike. And then we moved to Portland and didn't know a lot of people here, but my fiance Emily is an interior designer, and she went to school here, and we just got to know people. That was probably 99 97, I don't know, somewhere in 98, let's call it 98.
And has Portland been pretty center for you pushing yourself to do to get into publishing, or is this something that you kind of felt after kind of seeing what you want to see put out?
Has it been what?
Has it been played a role in you publishing your own work?
Oh.
Because it's such a cartoonist mecca.
Yeah,
I shouldn't use that term anymore.
When I moved here, it wasn't quite as big a cartoonist mecca. There were enough people, but it was still a little bit smaller, and I think, I don't know, it's weird, because I was in the Bay Area during, you know, I was just listening to the Frankie Santoro show, and,
oh, yeah.
And I was in the Bay Area during that whole heyday, and so it seemed like when I moved here, there was hardly anybody doing it, and then, you know, it seems like within the past 10 years, it's just become just as much as it was in the Bay Area back in the early 90s, so, but, yeah. I guess it's also that I got to know people, too. So.
Now, you know, more promotion for Stumptown. I've been mentioning a bunch lately. Let's talk a little bit about the thing you're throwing on the Friday.
Oh. We're throwing a reading and award ceremony and book premiere at Guapo Comics on Foster Road, and it's at 8 p.m. on Friday the 25th, I think?
Yes.
Okay.
Now, what's the book that you're premiering?
There's going to be a couple books that premiere, but the big one is a book called Nerd Burglar, and it's a free comic anthology that Greg Means, Tugboat Press, Greg who runs Tugboat Press.
And Tugboat's the group that puts out Paper Cutter, right?
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
Fantastic anthology.
And Tim Goodyear, who does Teenage Dinosaur, he published a book by Dash Shaw and a new book by Matt Fury called Boys Club. They're both amazing. But he's also Bobby Madness's publisher now, too, which is sort of a coup. But he and Greg and I all just wanted to publish a free anthology and we decided to do it for Stumptown.
Nice.
And there's about eight artists in it. There are eight artists in it.
And
could name them all.
I know Sarah Olixic's in it.
Yep. And Priscilla did the cover and the story inside. Aaron Nels Stanky, did the the back cover and the story inside. Jennifer Parks, who's a member of the Pony Club Gallery, did a story. Who else? Tim Root, who's a Portland comics celebrity of sorts. He'd probably get mad at me for saying that too. Did a great story in it. Bobby Madness did a story that's bound to get us in trouble with somebody. And
awesome.
And last but definitely not least, two people actually. Geez, Elijah Brubaker and Sean Granton did a story about the Portland freeway system, which is amazing too. So it's a great book.
I'm looking forward to picking it up.
And it's free.
Last year, I tried to make it to the reading, but unfortunately, my traveling companions, I showed up with a couple of people at like midnight, and we missed everything and drank our sorrows away in some crappy Irish bar across the street.
Bar Carlo? Is that it?
Quite possibly. Very smoky, and I got a huge glass of bourbon that...
Ooh.
Yeah, some Knob Creek. I love a good whiskey.
Oh, yeah.
It's... Anyone who sees me in Stumptown, buy me some whiskey, and I'll be happy.
That's the way to your heart.
There we go. Yeah, that and comics.
I think Philip's like that too, right, Aaron?
Yeah.
Used to be. I've calmed down a little bit. But,
I don't know about that. I had him over at my place, and he had some of my, what was it? I can't remember now.
Some of that Scottish stuff. Like,
yeah.
Put you mad in the head.
Belvedere.
Wow. Yep.
Or is it Belvini? That's what it was. The Belvini. It was tasty stuff. But I digress. It's not the whiskey hour, so to say. I'm going to play a quick song break.
Okay.
What would you like to hear?
I think I would like to hear the Badfinger song. I think the ones I sent in were in order, I think.
Of what you want to hear? Oh, perfect.
Yeah.
Okay, and I burnt them off in that order. So, excellent. So we'll be right back, folks. Up next, Badfinger. We're for the dark. And Inkstead, CITR 101.9 FM.
Show me the clouds and I'll give you sky. if you want me to. Show me the crowds and I'll make you cry if you take me through. Well, it's not enough to be. If you gotta look, then you have to see.
CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Inkstead Show, the radio show where we talk about comics. Next week, I will be playing a special interview I did last month with Gary Panter. And I think after I edited all the music, it'll be 3 hours long. So if you're a Gary Panter fan, first hour will be played on air here at CITR 101.9 FM. And all of it will be available at inkstuds.com. And I had so much fun doing this. Like, it's hard doing a long interview like that, but that was one of the ones that left me hyped. So, very comparable to the time when I sat down with Kim Deitch for an epic amount of time. And I think the week after that will be Brandon Graham. Hopefully, I gotta track the boy down. He's in town a lot, so I'm gonna be on the road to Stumptown when that show's playing. So I gotta do pre-recorded ones. Good times. Good times. We're speaking with Dylan Williams about his publishing enterprise. I think that's the term we're going to use now. We've moved up from publishing house, Sparkplug Comics. Now, you've got some regular titles. Mm-hmm. Why don't we talk a little bit about some of those? And the two that strike the minds of me and Phil are the Tales to Demolish, as well as the Watching Days Become Years, and the newest thing, which I haven't been able to get my hands on, is the Reich series. Do I have them all?
I think that's it. There's some others that are technically ongoing series, but we've only done one issue or something. So.
They have yet to merit the continuousness.
Yeah.
So, I guess, tell us about Tales Demolished for people that might want to check it out.
Oh, wow. Well, there are only three issues, and we plan to continue on. Actually, right now, Eric's going to be doing a series for Buena Ventura Press out of Oakland, who I really like too. They're Alvin and I are sort of friends, and we, you know, have really similar taste in mm-hmm. comics.
I could see a lot of overlap between what the two of you do.
Oh yeah. He's actually publishing Ted May now too, who's did It Lives.
Yeah.
Doing a book called Dual Injury Comics with Ted. But Tales to Demolish is a series and sort of like a couple things I've published. Eric was taking it around at San Diego, and Ben Catmull called me from San Diego and said, Eric is walking around with the book trying to get people interested in it. And I was immediately ready to publish with that sight unseen. But Eric is probably one of my oldest influences in alternative comics or whatever. He did a book called Angry Man in the early 90s or whatever. Him and Zach Sally were both like gigantic influences on me. And so it was just made perfect sense to publish it. But Eric's stuff is, it's sort of all over the place. It's not always funny or serious, but it's always beautifully drawn and surreal. So I think those would be the two pitch words.
Oddball and Madcap. Madcap.
Huh. Yeah, it's not always Oddball, that's the thing, and no. It's not always Madcap, but I think the third issue really is. The first issue has his more like morose side, which I really like.
There's a beautiful part in the third issue, though, where he's making himself like a fried egg sandwich, and every time I make a fried egg sandwich now, I always think of that scene and the little bit of chili sauce. It's just it's so beautifully rendered. It's a really great little point in the story, and it makes the story stick, which I love that sort of the mundane every day and then switching to the fantastical, and it sort of got a little nice.
I think it's weird. His stuff always refers back to like the early Marvel comics, and I think there's that kind of mundane quality in the early Marvel comics too, where, you know, Peter Parker would do stuff like that. And I think that's a big influence on him, that kind of, like, you know, Ben Grimm having, like, you know, a whole relationship with the people in his neighborhood and things like that. that Eric was really into those.
I guess it's following it up to the next logical level. Kind of taking different aspects of the Marvel stuff. And Reich, now, it's about the pseudo-famed psychiatrist Wilhelm Reich, who was banned by the AMA. He's a fascinating guy. He died in jail, didn't he?
Spoilers.
I'm ruining the comic. See, I've been reading
actually,
all this stuff
for my
life.
Funny is Tim Goodyear and I were talking about this, and neither of us really want to read more about him because we love the way Elijah's telling the story. And so it's hard for me because, you know, I read it as he's doing it. And so people come up to me and talk to me about Wilhelm Reich, and I'm intentionally not learning more.
I'm sorry.
So now I know he dies. Great.
Well, everyone dies, you know? It's... William Burroughs has, I've got this great documentary where he's sitting there smoking weed in his Oregon box and stuff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's quite fascinating. So tell us a little bit about the series that he's got going that I didn't ruin already.
Well, it's I don't know, I'm trying to think about anything in particular that's, I don't know, I think Elijah's drawing is really what like, stands out in this series, I think. He's so interested in a time period and so interested in Germany, you know, so far all the issues have been in Germany. It's just really, you know, Germany before World War II, and there's just this great period of art and writing, and, you know, and he manages to weave all that into it, but also weave it into the drawing, too. It's not just, you know, it's not just facts. It's, you know, it's... really feels like the newest one feels like a Simplicissimus cover or something like that, which was a German humor magazine from that time period that has amazing art.
So he's really pushing to do different type of styles within it to kind of emote what's happening. Well, I hope I can find it.
I'll give you copies at Stumptown.
I'll show up hat in hand.
No whiskey, but copies.
Like I said, either whiskey or comics will make me a happy Robin. How is Sparkplug distributed? I can't talk today.
It makes me feel more at ease. How is Sparkplug distributed? It's distributed through the main place is where you're going to get Reich. It's through Diamond, actually. They've done really well for me so far, or for us, with it. And it seems like, you know, of course, it may hit their cutoff point at some point in there. But so far, it hasn't. We've done three issues through them. And it's done quarterly, so it's just, you know, he's putting out a new one. You know, for Stumptown, and there'll be, you know, another one 3 months or whatever later. And I think it's just, you know, it's available through that. It's also available through Tony Shenton, who's a sales rep for me that deals with stores, and he's a great sales rep. He's been able to get me into, like, all these kind of stores across country that I wouldn't have been able to do myself.
Like more bookstores.
He does do some bookstores, but for me, it's just basically the comic stores that wouldn't normally give, you know, independent stuff a chance.
Nice.
And I think he's also hitting a time period when comic stores are actually opening up to those things, thanks to, you know, other genres not doing as well.
Mm-hmm.
People are actually, and they're being, like, you know, sort of attention grabbing.
Readers are wanting to kind of try something different because the old thing is not really doing anything for anyone.
But and then also through Last Gasp, they actually sold the Orgone box, and they are big fans of Wilhelm Reich, so it's doing really well through them. They actually have been super supportive of all the Sparkplug books. I also sell a lot of stuff online too. I have a web store that keeps me busy all day long, keeps me from drawing my own comics sometimes.
And that's sparkplug.com or Sparkplug Comics?
Sparkplugcomicbooks.com.
There we go, comic books. Y'all go check it out right now if you're not driving a car. And if you're driving a car, it'll just be awkward.
Even if you're driving a car.
Yeah, just everyone's got that iPod thing that goes online. You can just do it. Now, your own comics.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little about that because you're a cartoonist as well. It's the Reporter, I think. Yeah, Reporter. Now, I've only read one issue that I was able to snake out of Phil's hand. He wasn't looking, and I snatched it like the ninja I am.
I thought I confiscated all the issues that Phil had.
No, stop. You didn't quite. I don't actually. I have them. Some of them are in an attic somewhere in Ireland, but
they're
the ones I have here. Not for long.
Sitting next to a case of Guinness.
Whoa.
There's no full bottles of Guinness in my attic.
So the Reporter, the one issue I read was Korean War group. Are they all the same story, or is it different stories? Like, tell me about it. Even though you sound deeply ashamed by it.
Well, I am deeply ashamed by it, but I guess it's a really personal book, so I don't really, like, you know. I don't know. It's that old thing about, you know, if you're really doing something for yourself, then why even bother publishing it in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
But it's they're all stories set in a small town named Willoughby, and they are, I don't know, they're all different stories. You know, that one was about the Korean War, but mm-hmm. one before it was about an armored car robbery. It was a failed comic book about an armored car robbery. That's what I meant to say. And then the newest one is just sort of a series of three philosophical debates. And it's at a party, and it's sort of modeled on Bruce Lee's The Game of Death. mixed with La Notte, film by Antonioni.
Now, one thing I noticed just with this one issue that I've read, unfortunately, I have not read the rest. One day I will. Is the extensive notes at the beginning of the the books that you read in the process of doing this, the Korean War story. How does that function into the storytelling for you, the research you're doing there?
Putting those in there was actually kind of a mistake. I got one review afterwards that said, you know, that there's so many books listed, but obviously none of them were used in the story, or there's no point in listing them all. So from now on, I'm never listing my references again. But I am an obsessive reader and reference historian, and basically, I'm the kid of two PhDs, so I just love to research things, and can't get enough of historical reference. So I just, you know, if I'm going to write about the Korean War, I want to make sure that I'm not going to portray things incorrectly and misrepresent stuff. So, or if I'm adding in surreal things, I want them to sort of feel like I'm putting them in there for a reason and not just sort of because I don't know what I'm doing or something.
So they work contextually.
Yeah.
I think that's really interesting because it's not a subject I knew much about, but it made me want to read more. And even Like, I don't think that review would be entirely fair, because I think when you read a book and are influenced by it, you're sort of to sense, you're sort of distilling, like, the sense of the books. It's not necessarily anything direct that you're taking, but to get a feel for it, get the sense of the time. And that definitely comes across in that issue, I think.
Yeah.
I'll pay you after the interview.
No, we are a non-profit radio station. No money's changing hands here.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
So we'll talk about that over emails. Okay. I'm going to do another quick song. I guess we'll throw on the Halo of Flies.
Yeah.
That sound good? Mm-hmm. And then we'll come back and rock a little more. Okay. CITR 101.9 FM. Song's got me all revved up. I just said, let's go. Okay, we get to talk about comics. Right.
Anybody ever picked a 45-minute song or anything like that?
Well, actually, I had one time someone picked a 12-minute song by, what's her name? British.
Kate Bush? Really?
Yeah, 12-minute Kate Bush song.
That's very topical, too, with the Reich thing. Wasn't her cloud busting was about Wilhelm Reich?
Was
oh,
it?
Wow.
There we go. Phil, you're a wealth of knowledge. He's the quietest guy, but all of a sudden he'll just pull this out of his ass.
I'm a poverty of knowledge.
A poverty of knowledge. And on that knowledge, I didn't know this, but Phil let me know before the interview some of the stuff that you've been involved with other than publishing.
Oh yeah, no. I was just pointing out that I'd noticed
the porno stuff or something else.
No, not quite. No, it's like
but that makes great radio.
You have a good involvement in various aspects of the comics history. No, I just noticed like in the last issue of Comics Art, they had that article on Jesse Marsh, and a lot of the pages that were reproduced were from comics from your collection, which I thought was very cool. And also you did. for the Journal a while back. You had a very interesting interview with Fred Gardiner, which I thought was very cool. I was very interested to hear how you got in touch with him first, or how that interview came about initially. Was that something that was that you initiated, or?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember exactly how it happened. I've been a fan of his comics, and you know, I'm basically been a fan of Golden Age comics since the minute I saw them. But
and maybe let people know who this gentleman is.
Fred Gardiner. He's a Golden Age comic artist. He died actually, I think, 2 years ago, I want to say. But actually, it might have been early 2007. He's most famous for having drawn a bunch of magicians in comics like Action Comics and for the Spirit magazine and things like that, the weekly newspaper comic. But he was friends with Eisner and all those guys. But he was pretty much a unique comic artist. He didn't really draw like anybody else. And he sort of came up with his own style and just, you know, hit the ground running and was in, like, the earliest comics. He's in Action Number One, I think. And he has a story about letting Siegel and Schuster in the door, but I'm sure other people do, too. but he's an amazing draftsman and storyteller, and the interview was just basically me just asking a bunch of stupid questions and him going on and on these great stories about his career as a postman and hunter, and I don't know, he roughed up the school principal or something like that. I forget the full story.
These old comic guys, they're tough SOBs. Oh, yeah. Like, I don't know, we gotta beef up the current crop.
Yeah, Phil and I like to go to the gym a lot.
Definitely.
Phil is trying to tell me I should be riding my bike to the radio station, which is about, what do you figure, 5-6 miles from where I live?
Yes, walk in the park.
Don't be a wimp. Come on.
Yeah. I'm a Nancy boy. Proud and true. So that's not the first experience you've had doing stuff on Golden Age stuff, though.
No. I'm trying to remember the first... Golden Age comic artists I talked to, but I don't know.
How about some highlights?
Highlights are Jerry DeFuccio, who was sort of the man behind the scenes at MAD for years, and I never really interviewed him, but he and I just corresponded a lot, and he was just the nicest guy. I think he might have been the person who got me Fred's address. He published Fred a couple times in the 70s, and he maintained an interest in his stuff well after Fred quit comics. But and Robin Snyder, who does the History of Comics, who's Ditko's publisher. I tried to write Ditko to talk to him about Mort Meskin, and he wrote back a one-page very nice letter that says, "I don't talk about anything."
Pretty much.
But I love Ditko. And actually, that's, you know, I don't know, he's the inspiration for me in more ways than just the art. But not that I'm a libertarian.
I was going to say, are you going to be all, like, telling me what's right and what's wrong and handing me a blank card?
I don't agree with his philosophy, but I'm definitely a fan of the way he tells it, or I'm a fan of his individuality.
Mm-hmm. That does seem to be a connecting theme with a lot of these folks. Like, they are people who have a very individual voice, I think.
Yeah.
Well, like
even across the stuff that from what you publish yourself to those people that you know you're interested in from the past, it's
Pete Bagg's a big old libertarian, and he's, you know, did he read his article in the Reason about hanging out with Ron Paul and being heartbroken when he heard about his racist rants?
Wow, no, I haven't read that. I read his thing about art. He wrote one a while ago. And actually, my last comic was sort of, like, not inspired by that, but it involved some inspiration from that.
And but, I know Chester Brown's a libertarian, too.
Yeah.
So it's...
I'm not going to expose my ignorance by asking for a definition or anything here. But
it's basically... a form of liberalism where it's really minimal government involvement at all. Like, we taxes is stealing.
Oh, it's like anarchy, sort of.
Well, no, there is. It is anarchist liberal libertarianism. There's definitely some crossover there. Pete Bagg believes we shouldn't be paying for roads. You know, like, now this is stuff that's on the record. I'm not going and spilling dirt about people. That'll be for the After Hours Inkstead show.
An individual viewpoint, anyway, is what's is important.
It's very individualistic. You know, it's we have right to our own destiny. You know, big viewpoints on imprisonment,
gun laws, marijuana,
arts funding. That's the interesting part.
Because
Chester Brown is very heavily funded by the Canadian Art Council. So, Alex Toth.
The artists I should mention, the older artists I should mention, is Alex Toth.
I was going to say,
gigantic influence on me and a million other people. But I corresponded with him for years. I'm actually doing a comic about that, and it'll be in the next Windy Corner magazine that Austin English edits.
Excellent.
Oh, it's doing a little research because I get my books mailed. I've mentioned this before in the show, and I'm gonna start working on a Toth book.
Oh,
and so I went through the bibliography. This is massive bibliography online, and your name came up in there as doing something Toth related. So what was that?
I don't know. I've done a few things. To remember the things in particular. One of the things, I published a collection of Jesse Marsh Tarzan's black and white illustrations that Toast did, allowed me to reprint his appreciation of Jesse Marsh for.
I think that might be it.
Yeah, there's been a few other things over the years. I don't know. I've tried to, like, sort of remove myself from doing interviews and things like that anymore, but I really like to be involved with getting that stuff out there. You know, I'm a gigantic Noel Sickles fan, and Toth is pretty much responsible for that. But he did a lot to shape my interest.
How did you get into researching these older comics? Because you seem kind of schooled on the alternative, but, I mean, these guys are a completely different beast.
Well, I don't... See, for me, they always seemed connected, and that's kind of one of the things that I'm... You know, I always have a problem with modern mainstream comics, is it doesn't really seem connected, and they don't seem like they're made by individuals as much.
No.
It seems like it's this sort of, you know, honed down science of putting out a comic where, you know, you combine the right elements and you get this.
It's like a recipe.
Yeah, exactly. And that's not really the way I saw comics as a kid. And so, you know, the minute I saw Toast stuff, the Black Canary story did in Adventure Comics, you know, when I was a kid, it just instantly stood out to me, and his style was so, you know, him and unique that it, you know, it just stuck with me. I think there's a collection of Golden Age covers that my library had when, you know, I was probably six or something, that was a big influence. But actually the biggest thing was Bill Blackbeard. I did an interview with him in Destroy All Comics, and he's been an influence of mine since my grandfather gave me the Smithsonian collection of newspaper comics.
Which is massive.
Yeah. Yes. And it's basically every cartoonist's Bible in a lot of ways.
Yeah, going all the way to Chris Ware, he'll be the first to say how important that book was to him.
And Bill Blackbeard is just one of the most important people in comics history, and I think I used to go over to his place every weekend, basically, every weekend I could, and just hang out and read comics and talk to him. And he opened up my eyes to, you know, all sorts of things.
He's been really central in the most recent stuff is the Crazy Cat collections with Fantagraphics. I think he's been pretty much the archiver there, hasn't he?
I think almost all, you'll find that almost all those strip reprints have somehow or have a connection back to him. The mm-hmm. Gasoline Alley stuff is, you know, Joe Matt and those guys were buying stuff from Dolph. You know, there's just all kinds of connections, and he's just sort of a linchpin in old comics fandom.
I can just imagine what his collection looks like.
That's one of the most interesting things I found about old comics is that there was a series of guys like Bill and like Jerry DeFuccio and Ron Goulart who basically kept it alive. And, you know, like Ron Goulart, you find letters that he wrote to artists. Like in Mort Meskin's collection was a letter he wrote to Mort Meskin when he was a teenager in the 40s. And he's just been a fan that long, and he's kept those guys alive and kept them interested. And, you know, there's a couple Ron Goulart books that really got me into that stuff. You know, the first Jesse Marsh I saw was in The Great Comic Artist or whatever it is.
That's something neat about these old guys is there's a certain love of what comics can do, which I don't find.
Although a lot of them will tell you they did it for the money, but...
You know what? They could have done other stuff for money.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a sort of a craftsmanship element to the way they approach it as well, I think, which is it's like they're building a really cool bit of furniture. It's like a real dedication, and it's sort of a it's very important. A respect for the work, I think.
Yeah.
I was looking through my own little name dropping. I was looking through George Metzger's art collection of his own original pages, and it's neat talking to him about how all these old guys will influence him and just how it's really passed down, and there's a certain love of the craftsmanship that he has in kind of putting that work into the art. So.
And you really feel a sense of, like, the lineage or whatever.
Mm-hmm. We all love comics. So what kind of stuff do we have to look forward to in the future of Sparkplug?
Well, for Stumptown, there's going to be Hot Breath of War, which is a book by Trevor Alexopoulos, who I published Mine Tonight.
Oh, Mine Tonight, yeah. Very cool.
And then there's going to be Reich Number 4 for that. And then at Mocha, there's going to be, which is in June, I think. Is it June or July? June.
Yeah.
Must be June. I'm going to publish a book called Inkweed by Chris Wright. It's an amazing cartoonist. And then Windy Corner, number 2, which has a list of creators that's pretty long, but it's edited by Austin English and sort of his vision, his friends, you know, people he likes in it. So.
Nice.
Those are the big things that are actually in the pipeline, but there's probably about 15 other books in the works too.
Well, one thing I noticed is you'll
Philip
have
needs to do a book. Where's your new book, Philip?
On the way.
He's got all these fabulous minis that would be great books in their own too.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Phil.
Someday, over the rainbow. Yep.
Okay, I'm avoiding the jokes. I was gonna say the rainbow, and I was like, oh, Phil. But it's interesting because you also have stuff by more established artists like the Edison Steelhead book that from Renee French, who we all love. We love you, Renee. Put out more books.
She's going to listen to this and get mad at me for not mentioning her at all. I should have led with Renee French.
There we go. You'll get hateful, scathing emails. But that's a fantastic little like side project thing. And is that kind of the reason why you put that out as just a little side thing to her other stuff?
Yeah, I'm just a gigantic Renee fan, and I just feel like super honored that she let me do that book. It was more just she had those drawings, and I loved seeing she would just send those drawings out and post them online, and they're just so beautiful. And I actually said, you know, hey, you should do those as a book. And then she said, well, why don't you put them out as a book? I was like, really? If you say so. But I love that book. And she's a big influence on me right now, just in like I love how vague her art is right now and how it's just not, you know, it doesn't fit into what everybody else is doing again. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of individual.
It leaves a lot to the imagination. Yeah. I agree. It's fabulous, and it's interesting because she's kind of straddling the different kind of genres, so to say, that we have in this small milieu of comicdom. So everyone loves her stuff. A couple other ones that stick out is the Matt's travelogue, Asiatic.
Asiatic, yeah.
Which, was that just something he was intending on doing before he went, or is it something that stuck to him after traveling? It's quite interesting, little trip through Laos,
Cambodia. You know, I don't know whether he went into it intending to do that. He travels a lot, and I think he draws a lot, the two just met. But, yeah, it was something that he was, you know, taking around, and I've been a gigantic fan of his. Actually, it's funny, Frankie was talking about San Francisco and that newspaper that Matt's published in, like, the early 90s or something, mid-90s. But I've been collecting his. Actually, he was in some of the same mini or, like, self-published stuff that I was in, an anthology called Grunge in, like, 91 or 90 or something like that. And we're, you know, met then, and I've just been a big fan of his since then.
Now, one of the more, challenging comics of recent memory, challenging in a good way, is Asthma by John Hankovich.
Yeah.
That's quite a fascinating book that you guys put out, or you put out.
Yeah. Well, with that one, it was us guys, because John basically designed the whole book, and I just said, okay. And I've discovered that's one of the secrets to being a good publisher and editor is, you know, trying to catch mistakes, but basically just shutting up and letting the artists do what they do best, which is, you know, their comics.
Mm-hmm.
And Asthma is probably one of the books I'm most proud of, and, you know, it's rare. I like to keep costs low, but that book in particular, you know, it was worth it to do.
Well, it can't be any smaller.
Exactly, that size. Yeah, exactly. And John is just one of the, you know, the hidden great comic artists of our time. Seriously.
Is he going to have a new thing coming out at any point?
He's got stuff in MoM, and he's working on a series. He did a mini called Bald Knob that came out in the past 6 months, I think, and it's beautiful. I think John is a case of somebody who's a I don't mean to say this, but a real artist who doesn't, you know, it sort of goes back to what I was saying earlier about, you know, not publishing your stuff and not seeing it as something where you're desperately trying to get people into your comics. He just does them, and if other people are interested in them, then that makes him happy. But he doesn't, you know, he doesn't go out there. He does not submit to anybody. He doesn't submit his comics to publishers. I mean,
it's his book, and he's doing it.
Yep.
Well, we are at the end of our hour, unfortunately. The next show is standing outside with their crates of records. So thank you for taking the time to chat with us today, Dylan.
Thank you guys, both of you.
Thanks a million, Dylan.
And keep putting out the goodness.
Will do.
Thanks, okay.
You too.
Thanks, man.
Bye.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
One last little thing. Dylan Williams, publisher of SparkPlugComics.com.
Comicbooks.com.
Yep. Phil has an announcement, something that's happening on Saturday.
Yeah, down in Vancouver. There's part of the Illustrated Journey project, which is a project where newcomer youth to Canada have done their own comics based on their experiences traveling. And they're basically going to have an exhibition and a book launch on Saturday, this coming Saturday, the 12th of April. And it's down at the Mount Pleasant Community Centre, and that's just 800 East Broadway, just a block east of Fraser. And it's the main event is kicking off at 2, and there's food and stuff there, and you can get to see the kids' artwork, get to see the book. Some of the stuff is really amazing. Like, there's kids that never drew a comic before. They came along, did the classes with Hoshue Menjivar and Jonathan Dalton back last year, and this year as well, a bunch of other artists, and some really terrific stuff, and it's well worth a look if you're in and around. That's on Saturday at the Mount Pleasant Cultural Centre.
There we go. And I'll probably be there, and Phil will probably be there, and I hope you'll be there if you're in Vancouver. If not, you're lost. CITR 101.9 FM. Up next is Crimes and Treasons.
You lack the minerals and vitamins, irons in the niacin. Fuck who that I offend. Rapper, sit back, I'm about to begin. Bow, foul, talk, you squall. Never even walked the wall. More or less destined to get tested. Never been arrested. My album will manifest many things that I saw, did, or heard about, or told firsthand. Never word of mouth. What's in the future for the fusion and the change? Your rappers are in danger. Who will you switch to be a remainder? When the missile is aimed to blow you out of the frame, some will keep their limbs in, some will be maimed. The same suckers with the gab about killer instincts will turn bitch, you know, and damn where they lack in this division, the connoisseur. Cracking your head with a 4x4. Realize, sucker, I'll be the coming like Noah. Always simmer you down, perpetrating facade in what you consider an image. To me, this is just a scrimmage. I feel I'm stoned. Not cause a bopper wear my cap cocked. The more emotion I put into it, the harder I rock. Those who pose lyrical but really ain't true, I feel.
Crimes and treason.
Tongues about what you did, but you never done it. Admit it, you bit it, cause the next man came platinum behind it. I find it ironic, so I researched and analyzed. Most write about stuff they fantasize. I'm fed up with the bull on this focus of weed and clips and Glocks getting caught and wax not being flipped. It's the same old, just straining from the anal. The contact is not complex to vex. So why you pushing it? Why you lying for? I know where you live, I know your folks. You was a sucker as a kid. Your persona's drama that you acquired in high school and acting class. Your whole aura is plexiglass. What's the face told me you shot this kid last week in the park? That's a lie. You was in church with your mom. See, I know. Yo, slow your roll. Get it good to go. Guys be locking in this thing called rapping just for dough. Of course, we gotta pay rent so money connects. But I'd rather be broke and have a whole lot of respect. It's the principle of it. I get a rush when I bust some dope lines or roll. That maybe somebody will quote. That's what I consider real in this field of music. Instead of putting brain cells to work, they abuse it. Non-conceptual, non-exceptional. Everybody's either crime-related or sexual. I'm here to make a difference. Besides all the riffing, to traps I'm not sticking. Rappers stop flipping for those who pose lyrical but really ain't true, I feel.
Their time's limited, hard rock too.
Ladies and gentlemen, tuned in to 101.9 FM, CITR. Crimes and Treasons in full effect. Time.